Hello and welcome to CIFAR Sounding. I'm your host, Simba Wiltz.
And I'm Asla Gonser.
CIFAR Sounding is a production of Central Florida Animal Reserve,
where we engage the world of the big cats through our mottos of compassion, conservation, and commitment.
At CIFAR, when it comes to big cats, it's about vision.
You can find out more about us on our website at cflar.org.
We're also on social media. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/cflar and on Twitter at cflarbigcats.
We also have a YouTube channel at youtube.com/CFL Animal Reserve.
Our conversation continues this week with Jordan Joseph, business coordinator and volunteer coordinator for Caddyshack Ranch, located in Jacksonville, Florida. Now, when you've had your handling experience, have you found that there have been new levels of language that have developed between you and the cats that you've become close to?
You know, I never really thought of it that way. I think, you know, I would say yes, unknowingly, that, you know, I haven't really put a lot of thought into that aspect of it. But thinking about previous experiences and experiences with domestic animals, that I know my dog can't talk to me and she may not know exactly what I'm saying, but I swear that she can complete sentences. You know, I can tell her a sentence and she completes it. I think that there is some form of communication that we might not be aware of, whether our energy or something, that the cats fairly understand what our intention is, and vice versa, I would think. You know, a lot of our cats, even having toothaches and having to inspect a toothache, they tolerate it. Giving fluids to a black leopard that otherwise would definitely want to taste your ankle, you know, is allowing us to give her fluids without having to sedate her. And that's very important. And I just think that they tolerate that. I think that they completely understand that we are there to help. I think that's what makes a lot to her. That makes a happy animal, is an understanding.
Well, and you're building relationships with those cats too. Obviously, certain volunteers probably have better relationships with certain cats than other volunteers.
Absolutely. And I think that's with any kind of animal caretaker, you know, and again, these are not pets, but I hate to make an association, but like your own pet, you do know them better than a stranger. And I think that that's very important to have a relationship with them and a trust, for sure.
Well, I was even meaning like between volunteers, like I know we've talked about this many times at CIFAR. We have one cat that, for example, prefers females over males. And, mm-hmm. you know, so there are some idiosyncrasies to that. And then, of course, there's other cats that have certain people that they consider their humans and aren't as close to the other humans.
Yeah. Oh, gosh, yes. I can think of several examples for sure. We have one leopard. I feel so terrible. He's a wonderful volunteer. He's just absolutely, he's just great. Does everything all around. And one black leopard that he loves all the animals, just can't stand them. And just growls at him every time, and he builds her hammocks and fixes her den box and all kinds of things and just can't stand them. And I've seen that, you know, in myself. You know, I mean, I love all the animals, and I understand that some of them may not like me as much as I like them, and that's okay. That's certainly their prerogative.
I guess that's true with humans too, so what do you do, you know?
What do you do? You can't make everybody happy.
No.
Or every fuzzy, for that matter, either.
No. My cat, we are always, my house cat, always back and forth on whether she loves me or she hates me.
That's kind of indicative of house cats, though, isn't it?
Very. It's like a term not entirely fitting in this, but it's like herding cats. It's just entirely up to them. They are on their own schedule, for sure.
We've used that phrase before, saying, okay, it's your idea. You just...
Yes, I know.
Just let it happen.
Every time we move cats, it's all right, herding cats.
It's a difficult thing to go through, I'm sure. See, you mentioned hammocks a couple of times. I want to picture this. What do you have as a cat hammock?
So what we do is we saw this through another, actually, it's on a website called Rexano. And we just found that a lot of other sanctuaries were starting to build, and a lot for especially primates, these suspended hammocks, or they're built onto a wooden frame, and they're made out of recycled fire hose, and they're weaved together. And so we started building those for our cats. We actually have right now 5 Eagle Scouts that have also built. We give them the set of instructions. We tell them the supplies. They fundraise, and they come back a couple weeks later with a hammock built. And it's so cool because then they get to watch the cat lounge on it for the first time, and it's a great experience on both ends. And they're really cool. They're really interesting. Some of them aren't so indestructible. Our cats do like to chew on them, like anything new, and they have to investigate, but a lot of them, it's so funny to see 3 full-grown cats laying on one hammock that's about 4 by 8 feet. So it's a sight to see if you've ever seen cats snuggle so well.
Oh, yes. They do like to get together. You mentioned how you had the Eagle Scouts come out and do that. And one thing that we have noticed, especially as we've been talking to the community that we're moving towards, is about how many wonderful ways that a big cat organization sanctuary can actually become a vital part and a viable part of a community. Tell us about how you've done your community outreach and how that has had a positive impact on the environment around you.
You know, I would say a lot of the community outreach has almost come to us. I mean, it started, I know, I've only been in the volunteer coordinating position just over a year, December of 2013. And we get a lot from CarMax, a lot from Bank of America that come on a monthly or a quarterly basis throughout the year, and they do work for about 4 hours. But another important thing, I mean, we strive so hard on the education side because that's what we have. All we have is to educate the public about something that they aren't aware of, and then they can go and spread the word. So we do a lot with field trips, like I said, and they get to come out, either get a guided tour. Some of them will come out and do a volunteer project, build an enclosure or not a full enclosure, but platforms or something inside hammocks. And also internships. We do provide internships for 4 different colleges in town. And so that's something that's very important as well, is to be able to give them somewhere where they can learn. I mean, of course, a lot of it's not hands-on, but they get to learn the whole workings of it. And I think I schedule so many, and it's college students, and for them to come in and learn about something that they didn't know about, or even, you know, do something for the environment to a degree, is benefiting the community. And as far as the other companies that come out on a monthly or quarterly basis, they get a lot out of it as well. And they're having to learn how to team build, which is why most of the companies send them to us.
So that they can learn how to team build the tiger that they can see versus the one that they can't in the office.
Yes, I suppose you could say that, yeah.
So you also mentioned internships. What kind of degree programs are those interns in?
We've had engineering, we've had nonprofit management, we've had some programs with board member training, basically, learning how to be board members on nonprofit organizations. Of course, some pre-vet, zoology, vet techs, which we do a lot with. Engineering has been a big one, I would say, one of the biggest.
Well, that's interesting to me because I went to school as an engineer, and I'm not sure I understand how that connects.
Yeah, and it's a very upcoming, I think, very valuable major. But here in Jacksonville, we actually don't have any colleges or universities that offer zoology or pre-vet. The closest would be Gainesville.
Okay.
And so we get some vet techs, but not a whole lot of zoology, not like I'd like to see as. That's my major, so.
I'm just trying to, you know, picture how engineering fits in with it.
Designing enclosures.
Okay.
UNF, which is University of North Florida, they did a big senior project for us, and they actually, we had a piece of property in mind, which is now out of mind, and they basically designed everything from where the enclosures were going to go, what kind of water supply, electrical, what kind of building structure, just everything, the entire thing from start to finish, you could take the whole thing to a builder. So.
That's great.
It's pretty cool to see the students be able to work on something like that.
Yeah, that is a great, great application.
So what's on your hot button list at the moment? Big cats, there's a lot of stuff going on right now in the big cat world. What's on your hot button list that really needs discussion?
You know, I think you touched on it earlier. I think the public interaction, I think, is a real tough one. You know, we feel the brunt of it. And I think it's something that really needs to be adjusted. I mean, I watch, you know, it's funny. I sit here and watch Animal Planet, and I watch, you know, animal care officers or the like, USDA, Florida Fish and Wildlife, see them preventing people from doing it all the time on TV. But yet I feel like I don't see it happening around me. I don't see it actually happening.
What are you saying? Prevent what?
Preventing the public handling programs. I'm not sure. The only thing that concerns me about them, and it's a great thing, you know, even for sanctuaries, because they're able to raise a lot of funds in a minimal way. But at the same time, I think people go home, and we fight this all the time, that they don't make good pets, that people go home thinking, well, I could do that at home.
So you're saying there's actual public handling, like where you bring in someone to actually, like, that doesn't work, that isn't a volunteer, doesn't work there, but actually comes and pets the cats?
Or like swimming with a tiger, that kind of thing.
Yes, I think I know where you're going with that one.
Mm-hmm.
Swimming with a tiger sounds...
I won't touch on that one, but, you know...
That just sounds crazy to me, but I don't know.
Maybe... It is crazy. I mean, I know there's a lot in Miami, Florida. I recently, you know, it... And I had to say, Mom, you know, I don't like to hear this, but apparently a cousin of mine had gone down to somewhere in Miami, and they had wanted to hold a monkey. And I wish I could have schooled him up a little bit beforehand. You know, I'm not saying that I wouldn't like to hold a monkey. That's very interesting. But at the same time, there's a price to that. And I think that nobody, you know, the general public isn't understanding that. But yet, you could just spend $50, $200 or more to touch a cub, which is where we get a lot of our cats sometimes. And basically, they call them picture babies. I'm sure you guys know that term.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is a big problem. I think those are a lot of times not only accidents waiting to happen, but, you know, it's those bad apples that spoil it for the whole bunch.
And you're saying that you get those cats, meaning that once those cubs are grown and can't be handled that way anymore or be the picture babies, they end up in sanctuaries.
Yes, pretty much. Simba, please correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that Florida recently changed it to it's legal for the public to handle them 25 pounds or less.
That's accurate. So we are a three-tiered state now. So if they are less than 25 pounds, then they can have unrestricted contact. If they are less than 40 pounds, but younger than 9 months, I believe, then they can have controlled contact with a handler. And if they're over 40 pounds or over that age limit, there's no contact at all allowed.
Well, that's a step in the right direction, I guess. Yeah.
Well, it's actually counterintuitive, because now it creates a window whereby, as long as you have enough cubs of that age consistently, then you can continue to make an awful lot of money.
Yeah, and that's bad. Of course, they're breeding the cats that end up in sanctuaries, because when they're done with them, they're done with them.
Of course, they can't make any more money off that cat. They wouldn't want to afford any kind of expenses for that cat.
To say, I don't think I was aware that this was even available, that you could go and, you know, pet a cat. I just didn't know that.
Oh yeah, it's more common than you think. It's really sad. I mean, amongst many other different kinds of animals as well. And I mean, you know, I think about it, if I don't have children, but I could only imagine, you know, you have, you know, a 6-month-old baby. Do you want all kinds of people touching that baby? You know,
yeah, that's true.
You know, that's kind of the way I think about it. And again, what I think is the biggest struggle with it is that will make somebody go home and think, I could do that at home. And then we have a never-ending problem.
So kind of going with that, what are your guys' thoughts on breeding?
We always preach, it's on all of our T-shirts, extinction is forever, and this is so true. But we don't support breeding irresponsibly. And of course, that's very, very loose term there. But the best way that I always kind of just handle this one is basically, is it moral or responsible to go to a dog breeder when your local shelter is overflowing? It's not the, I don't know if ethical is the right word, but the responsible thing to do. And that's kind of the way that we feel about it. And we have animals that are capable of breeding, but they're either separated. Anybody else is going to be spayed or neutered if they're with another cat. So, of course, we practice spay and neuter. And we aren't currently looking or interested in breeding at the moment, because we get the same calls to take in animals that we currently have. So why would we breed the cats to take up home or take up room for cats that need homes? It's just asinine. But again, if there ever came a need, the one thing if it's supporting a population, I mean, do we let, and that's again, going back to one of our original topics, is it more important to survive a species in the wild or to survive almost a species at all? So it's tough. You know, I myself, my own personal opinion, not necessarily that of Caddyshack, but I would like to see, you know, all the cats be able to have homes in the wild for the rest of their lives, you know, for the rest of Earth, basically, if you know where I'm going. I don't ever want them to become extinct, but how can we prevent that?
You raise a great question, particularly because the native lands are not in the United States. If we had our legal system, if we had our system of contributive government, I put that in quotes, then we conceivably could solve the problem just like we solved it, say, with the bald eagle, where there was a huge effort to try and make sure that we kept our national mascot. Now, there's another country that has a very important national mascot that occasionally struggles to try and keep their national mascot alive. And that, of course, being India and the other native lands of the tigers specifically. And we know that should we as a country decide that we're going to truly cut off all breeding and everything, then we're basically outsourcing the future of these cats to countries and governments that we may not be able to rely on in perpetuity. So it does create that catch-22 whereby the only way to learn how to do it right is to do it, but yet it's still not appropriate for us to do it as long as there is a current need.
Right. Yeah, you know, that's just a tough one. It's like one of those things that you almost just don't want to cross that bridge until it comes. But I know that a lot of sanctuaries feel that, you know, we would like to put ourselves out of business, but as long as there are people that continue to make a profit off of this, as long as there's people willing to pay for these kinds of programs or hands-on interactions, we are always going to have to survive. Sanctuaries are always going to have to be around to basically clean up the mess.
Indeed. We're kind of in an unusual situation like that, where we occasionally can have a certain degree of moral authority because we are both involved, but we're not involved. We are both powerless, but yet a major factor, the glue in keeping the two sides together, but occasionally self-destructive, as we've seen sanctuaries that have certainly taken unusual turns in the name of trying to save big cats to do extreme things that are essentially eating the industry by its own tail.
I kind of ask myself, again, maybe more of a personal opinion, but I ask myself, you know, a lot of these zoos, as we know, their species survival plans, they come about because most of the time, they take the species out of the wild. They want the pedigree. They want the best of the best and the strongest to breed within captivity to keep a great bloodline. And to me, that's really tough. But again, how do we survive the species? How do we do it responsibly? And unless we take them out of the wild, I mean, there's already so many in captivity, and I would feel that we should keep them in the wild. Again, I see both sides. And then that raises the question to me as far as what do they become like? Do you almost end up, I mean, I know that they're still striped, they're still a Siberian tiger, but do you end up with a different cat? And I think to some degree you do, but do you end up with a different cat once they've been bred and bred and bred in captivity than you would in the wild? I think you're looking at a different animal.
You do. And sometimes it can even be down to the physiology. For example, we know that in captive populations of lions, for example, that there's often a malformation that takes place in the skull where it can actually be thicker than that of its wild counterparts, which puts an unusual pressure on the brain and eventually causes neurologic deficits to develop either early in life or sometimes late in life. We are, in some ways, the cat's only savior and their own worst enemy in that regard, especially if we're only finding out that answer on necropsy.
Right. Well, it's just, I think we eventually evolve to something. And I would think that, you know, you're looking at different aspects, different environments, different challenges, different rewards than in captivity versus in the wild. So eventually you're going to end up with a different kind of animal. So to me, I think that's why it's very important that we try to sustain as much as we can of a wild population. I know, sadly, here in Florida, and you guys probably share this pain as well. I recently read in our paper that we had over 30 or about 30 Florida panthers killed this year in traffic accidents. And so we're down to 100. And I think that the local, I know White Oak Conservation has had extensive efforts in trying to bring back the population. But from what I understand, it wasn't very successful, or it's not as successful as they would have hoped.
No, I think that they tried to release 8, and of the 8, 6 didn't make it.
So that, you know, it's devastating. So So, but then I you know, go right back. It's right back in a circle. So do we keep that species alive here in captivity?
There's an interesting turnabout question that I'll ask you from a philosophical standpoint. It's said that no species survives prolonged contact with humans, but it is also notable that being around the cats makes subtle changes in a person, in the way that they go about life and the way that they engage life. Have you noticed any changes that you feel like are kind of the pre-cat you and the post-cat you?
Gosh, well, I'm definitely finicky. I would say, you know, I think in general, it's no particular species of cat that's changed me. But I would say in the big picture, I have found something that to me is more important than anything. And of course, anything to do with animals. It doesn't have to be a big cat. It could be an elephant, a giraffe, any kind of animal, a raccoon. But I found something that's bigger than myself, and I wish that everybody had the opportunity to find something like that and make it a hobby or a job if they are able to, because it's not all about me and my needs and my woes. It's about something bigger than me and something that is so appreciative for the things that I do. And it took me a long time to really think that they appreciate that or they remember me or recognize me, because I almost didn't want to be disappointed. But with the five girls, as I mentioned before, I really feel that. And they've really just, to be able to do something, I mean, like maybe some people feel when they work at a retirement home, you feel that you're giving something the best life that it will possibly have. And to that, there's really no better feeling. I mean, to be able to give something back like that, it will forever change me. I don't think that I'll ever be doing anything other than something to do with animals and their livelihood. But yeah, I think that's the biggest thing. But again, I am finicky. I will definitely admit to that.
So what does Jordan Joseph look like in 10 years? You know, what's your long-term plan with regards to this path you've placed yourself on?
Well, gosh, that's a little scary. I'm only 25, and I know I keep saying I'm going to cry at 26.
You're going to cry at 26?
I'm not sure. You know, I would have to say that in 10 years, I hope I'm as happy as I am today. For one, I laugh because I'm in school at the moment, finally going for something that I enjoy and want to do with zoology. And I laugh and I tell people that anybody that asks, I love to tell people what I do, and not to rub it in their face because I love what I do on a daily basis, but because I'm so excited about it and I feel so fortunate that I get, you know, there are people that live their entire lives and never get to do what they love to do, even as a hobby. But I hope that I have traveled, that I have seen these animals out in the wild. And that's a big, of course, trips like that are very expensive. So that's the main thing. And when you're a volunteer, that can be a bit difficult to maneuver. But I definitely would like to see them in the wild. I mean, I would just like to get a taste, you know. But I would like to have, I don't know, I know it's silly, very, very vague, but I would like to just be able to soak up as much information as possible. I am like an endless observationalist. I just love to watch anytime the vet's out here, anytime, you know, our director is telling me something or doing something, I just love to observe it, because the more I keep my mouth closed and just watch the things going around, the more I learn. And I'm very fortunate for that I'm given that opportunity. But like I said, I would hope I'll be done by school. I hopefully will be done by school by then. But hopefully still at Caddy Shack. Why would I leave?
That's where your cats are.
That's where, yeah. How could I leave the cats?
Where are you going to school?
I'm at University of North Florida, but like I said, here in Jacksonville, they don't offer any kind of zoology. So I'm actually going to be transferring beginning of next year. I had to not retake classes, but I had to take a bunch of classes that originally weren't on my academic roadmap. So I've kind of I had to make up some time, but I'll be transferring down to University of North Florida if they'll have me for zoology.
You mean University of Florida?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yes, yeah. University of Florida.
Okay.
Yes, that's in Gainesville.
Yes. That'll be quite a commute for you, though, getting back to Caddyshack then, won't it?
It will. It'll be, it's about an hour and a half from where I am, which, you know, I could drive to the other end of Jacksonville, and it would have taken me an hour and a half, so it won't be too terrible. I plan on trying to schedule my classes on 1 or 2 days, but they have great online programs as well, so.
Well, it's wonderful that you're pursuing that, making it your lifelong pursuit, and as you said, that you're lucky enough to be able to find what makes you happy and be able to hopefully have a career in that field.
Yeah. I hope I'll be back on the radio with you guys representing Caddyshack.
Well, thank you so much for coming and joining us today and having a conversation with us and introducing Caddyshack to everybody.
You are very welcome. I'm glad to be here and glad I could express my passion for Caddyshack and all the big cats.
Jordan Joseph, Caddyshack. Don't miss it up in Jacksonville if you're ever up there.
C4 Sounding is a production of Central Florida Animal Reserve,
where we engage the world of big cats through our mottos of compassion, conservation, and commitment.
At CFAR, when it comes to big cats, it's about vision.
Send us your thoughts. You can get us on email via contact@cflar.org.
Tune in again next week for more discussion. My name is Asla Gonser.
And I'm Simba Wiltz. Thanks for listening to CFAR Sounding. Thank you.